You know, people are scared of the things that they don't know. And I think the fact that there is no sex education in Poland, they don't even know what sex education is, most of them. They say I'm sexualizing kids.
Das ist Vogue Stories, der Podcast von Vogue Deutschland. Meine erste Vogue habe ich vor 15 Jahren in den Händen gehalten. Ich war Babysitterin in Wien. Stundenlang saß ich im Schneidersitz auf dem teuren Designersofa und blätterte durch die Seiten der Vogue, nachdem ich Max ins Bett gebracht hatte. Als kleines, uncooles Mädchen, das so schüchtern war, dass es Menschen teilweise nicht richtig in die Augen schauen konnte, waren die Seiten ein Zufluchtsort. Magisch und weit entfernt. Seit einem Jahr arbeite ich genau an dem Ort, an den ich mich früher nur geflüchtet habe. Mein Team und ich arbeiten fleißig an der Neuausrichtung der Seite. Dabei wundere ich mich oftmals, warum die Vogue eigentlich so ist, wie sie ist. In diesem Jahr wird die deutsche Vogue 40 Jahre alt. Ich möchte hier die Menschen treffen, die Vogue geprägt haben, die Vogue machen und die Vogue sind. Ich möchte die Welt, in die ich mich früher nur geträumt habe, noch besser kennenlernen. Mein Name ist Alexandra Bondi De Antoni. Willkommen bei Vogue Stories. Ich bin heute in Berlin und treffe gleich das polnische Model Anja Rubik. Sie ist in der Stadt, um Freunde zu treffen, und nach langem Hin und Her klappt es heute endlich mit unserem Gespräch. Anjas internationale Karriere begann als Gesicht von Chloé. Sie lief schon für fast jeden Designer da draußen und war auf so vielen Covern zu sehen, dass man schnell den Überblick verliert. Außerdem hat sie ihr eigenes Parfum und Magazin herausgebracht und steht nicht nur vor der Kamera, sondern auch hinter ihr. Sie ist eines dieser Models, das seine Plattform und seinen bekannten Namen nützt, um Gutes zu tun. Durch ihren Kampf für Sexualaufklärung in ihrer Heimat Polen wurde sie zum Staatsfeind Nummer 1 erklärt. Das hält sie aber nicht davon ab, immer weiterzumachen. Sexed.pl ist eine Plattform, die es Menschen und gerade Jugendlichen ermöglicht, offen über Sex zu sprechen. Und weil wir ja eh alle Sex haben und Aufklärung so etwas Wichtiges ist, was aber irgendwie immer vergessen wird, sprechen wir jetzt genau darüber. You were born in Poland and then moved to Paris to start your modeling career. Mm-hmm. Can you maybe take me back to that time and explain how you got into modeling?
Mm. Well, it's quite interesting because I was born in Poland, but I traveled a lot as a kid. And where I left Poland when I was 5 years old, we lived in Greece for 3 years, then we moved to Canada for a year, then South Africa. And really in South Africa, I started to be interested a little bit in fashion. And then that was also the time when George Michael videos started coming out. And to me, that was so fascinating. And I lived in a completely different world because both of my parents are vets. They work with animals. So there has, you know, I had no connection to fashion, no real connection to art. I mean, my mom loves to dress up and she loves makeup. And she was always, it was quite funny because she's a vet, but she would always wear a heel and full on makeup to go to work. And, you know, I remember watching those videos and I didn't really, you know, I didn't connect it to fashion as much, but I saw the video that I'm talking about is Too Funky. And I remember watching it and thinking, wow, like these women seem to me so independent, so powerful and strong with the whole world at their feet. And I thought, I want to be one of these women. And that was something that was very attractive to me. And you know, it somehow sparked an idea of entering the fashion world. I mean, I was a kid. I was like 8, 9 years old. And I remember I would watch the videos on VHS and go back 3 minutes and 25 seconds. I remember till now to watch a video over and over and over again. And then I came back to Poland when I was around 12, 13. And I grew taller and taller and skinnier and skinnier. And, you know, it was fashion really didn't exist in Poland back then. And the information that I had, this is pre-internet time. I didn't have that much information. So there were just pieces of information here and there that would cut out of magazines and, you know, something about Linda Evangelista and something about, Nadia Auermann. And it was a dream. I kind of really believed deep down that it is possible, although realistically, if you think about it, I was in a small town in Poland. I had no connection to that world, but I believed somehow it's going to happen.
Did you already knew what a model was, or was it more the idea of fashion that you were so attracted?
I understood what a model was, but I didn't really understand what the job was. I was attracted to those girls from those videos that were just so independent and free and beautiful and they've just ruled. That's what I was really attracted to.
And when you got into modeling then a few years later,
yes,
how was that the reality that you saw? Or
I mean, I started through a competition. I entered a competition when I was 14. I didn't win the competition. And then I entered another competition that I didn't win as well. But that competition was organized by my mother agent in Poland, by someone that still represents me till now. And I started to travel. They found me an agency in Milan, then in Paris, and I started traveling. And yes, it was different because, you know, when you have a dream, you never think about the amount of work that is behind it. You just think about the goal, you know, the final, when you reach, and the success. But in many ways, it surprised me in a very positive way. You know, you travel, you meet incredible people, you meet extremely talented people that love what they do. And, you know, what they do is their entire life. And it's the whole process, the creative process, is really fascinating. And if you're, as a model, if you're smart enough and you're interested enough, you can learn so much, and you have this incredible opportunity to learn from other people. When I worked a lot with Karl Lagerfeld throughout the years, and I always laughed that next to him, I turn into the sponge because I want to absorb as much of information and everything that he has to give. So, you know, and like I said, you travel, you meet other cultures. You really, I think modeling, although it has its, you know, difficult sides, of course, we're very, or anyone really in the fashion industry, we're very privileged to be part of it. Mm-hmm. And we need to remember about that because it's very easy to forget.
Do you remember a specific moment or a situation where you realized that when you're like 10-year-old self in mm-hmm. Poland would have been, wow, Anya, you literally made it?
Well, there are a few of those moments, but one of the recent ones, because I still get that, you know, it's still a little bit unreal. Sometimes there are moments where I pinch myself. But there was a show, a Versace show in Milan, and they played the George Michael song. And all the girls were there because it was an anniversary show. And Naomi was there, and Claudia Schiffer and you know, Helena Christensen and a few others. And I was there. And at the moment, in one moment, I had tears in my eyes because it was so unreal. That song, them being there, me being part of the show. I was actually closing the show. It was very, very unreal.
That was an unreal moment.
Moment. And crazy. A couple of years back also, I did a Balmain show, maybe 8-9 years ago. And it was also the same song of George Michael. And I opened that show and it was quite unreal.
Do you remember your first connection with Vogue?
With Vogue? Well, I remember my first big story. Mm-hmm. And that was with Inès and Venud for French Vogue. I think it was in 2003 or 2004. And, you know, it was incredible because you're there and you cross your fingers that everything goes well and you give your best. And what is really fascinating is that, not fascinating, but what was interesting is that I was surprised that everyone in Vogue is so nice. And huh? I remember, I'm like, God, Emmanuel Alt is so nice. And Inès, I worked with her, you know, a few weeks earlier. She was so nice and everyone's so polite and caring. And I don't know, although I was already working in the industry for many, many years, you always think Vogue, you know, you think it's going to be someone a little bit more, not stuffy, but a little snobby. But it's usually the opposite, you know, it's usually the opposite. Some magazines that are not at the level of Vogue, they're snobby. And you go to Vogue and everyone's there waiting with open arms and they're lovely.
What advice would you give some young models that start out now?
You know, you have to really believe in yourself. I know this is very obvious, but in a way where this is your career. No one's going to take care of your career as well as you will. you have to understand that agencies, well, working with agencies, it's a collaboration. A model does not work for an agency. This is, you work together as a team. And, you know, hope is not a strategy. You work your way up, be professional, understand it's a business, understand that you're there together. It's when you're on set, it's, you know, you're working together. It's a collaboration to create something. And you have to understand that a model, very often, you know, you are part of the process, but at the end of the day, you embody a vision of the photographer, of the editor. You have to find yourself within that space. You have to understand that your part is in a way to inspire, and understand the vision and be able to extend it further. I think that's really, really important that girls don't necessarily immediately get that. But the collaboration with the agency is very important, because a lot of girls, they start, they're really scared of their agents. They're different agencies. Some agencies obviously abuse their power. So just understand you're not working for them. You're working with them. This is your career. Take care of it. And, you know, if you manage, it's an amazing opportunity.
How long did it take you to find that out, or to be as strong with yourself to believe in that?
Maybe a few years. The moment I became a little bit comfortable with, you know, your own body and with your own self. I started very early. I wouldn't recommend that for any girl. I think 15, 14 is way too early, because you don't know who you are yet. You don't know what you like. And suddenly you drop into an industry that, you know, constantly gives you feedback, and everyone is expecting something else and something different from you. And when you're, you know, when you're a bit older and you know who you are, it's easy to not play that game, but embody those personalities for a day. But when you're very young, you want to do your job well and you want to fulfill all these expectations, and it's very easy to lose yourself. You don't know. You hear, you know, you're too tall, you're too short, you have too much personality, you're too loud, you're too shy, you're not loud enough. And if you're just growing and creating yourself, it's quite difficult. But I think the young generation nowadays, they already have that with social media. I mean, social media is a hard one, because you get instantly so much, you know, comments and so much feedback on every element of your life. Mm. You put yourself out there. So maybe they have a thicker skin to start.
Mm. When I was preparing for this interview, I read this one article where you said that modeling is a feminist job.
Mm-hmm.
And from all what you talked before, I find that really interesting thing to say. And I think a lot of people wouldn't necessarily agree with that. Mm-hmm. So can you maybe elaborate a little bit on that?
Well, feminist, I don't know if it's a feminist job?
Yeah.
I don't know if I would agree with that right now, because, you know, feminism means just equal rights for both genders on every level, which you don't really necessarily get that in fashion, because girls actually earn more than boys in this industry, because there's just more, there is more money in female fashion than male fashion. But, you know, what I wanted to say is that this is actually a job where girls earn more than men. This is a job that is, I still think, quite dominated by women. I think in fashion, women tend to support each other. So I thought it's not as bad as people think, because people think we do create a vision of femininity and how, you know, something that people sometimes struggle, think that we impose a certain vision of femininity. But what is interesting nowadays, what changed, is that it became much, much more open to different kinds of beauty. I think right now what is interesting is fashion, that what is considered beautiful is originality. And that's a great place to be at. And when I said that it's feminist, I meant that we do dominate the industry, you know, in every sense of the way, because we get paid more. And there's so many women and they do support each other. And, you know, I just think it's when you're in the industry, you feel quite powerful.
So what does feminism mean to you in general?
Well, it means equality. It means, you know, men and women are worth the same. They should be treated exactly the same way. I don't think that you should be into certain things just because you're a woman or you're a man. It's just a level, equality on every level. Equality at work, equality when it comes to pay. That is what feminism means. It tends to go extreme and it's really misunderstood by so many people around the world. And very often women say, well, I believe in equal rights, but I'm not a feminist. I'm like, well, that doesn't really make sense. And then they say, well, why can't they just say equal rights instead of feminism? I'm like, well, because you need a word for a specific problem. Mm-hmm. You know, you have racism. This is a specific problem. People are discriminated because they have a different color of their skin. It has to have a name because then it exists. Mm-hmm. And the same with feminism. Women are discriminated only because they're women. You have to call it something. Mm-hmm. And of course, big one is men. You know, if men believe in equality, that sort of equality between sexes, they're feminists as well. Mm-hmm. It's not only reserved for women.
Where do you think do we stand as a society when it comes to feminism? What steps have to be taken towards a total equal society?
There's so many steps. I mean, I think, you know, understanding the second, you know, the other human being, understanding what feminism means. I mean, it's such a difficult question because it really depends where you are in the world, where you live. I mean, we're quite... we're lucky we're in Europe because what we're fighting for when it comes to equality, these are just, you know, the last bits that are left. There are places around the world where there's a extreme division still between men and women, and women don't have the same rights as men. So I think it really depends what country, you know, where you're at. Mm. But it's something we have to fight for, and it's quite disturbing that it's 2019 and we're still fighting.
And
we still talk about it. And there are places around the world where we're actually moving backwards, you know, that suddenly certain rights are being taken away from women. It's something that we have to be very, very careful with. And in a sense where just keep your eyes open because things change very, very fast. Don't be an extremist because I don't believe in any sort of extreme. But, you know, you have to push it forward and react if you're in a situation, even a social situation, and there is, you know, a sexist comment, it's good to react. Mm-hmm. You don't have to create a drama out of it. But if you don't react, that person might not even be quite aware that they said something that could be harmful mm-hmm. or that is sexist because they don't think about it. They're repeating something that they heard either from their parents or someone, a friend. And once you explain it to them and say, you know, this actually hurts me, or, you know, this actually isn't right what you're saying, they're going to stop and maybe change the way they see things. Mm.
You just mentioned that in some parts of the world, we're going backwards again. And I think that's maybe quite a good bridge to what you're doing with Sex at PL, what started in Poland. So with Sex at PL, you want people to talk about sex.
Yes.
And learn about sex education.
Yes.
So why is it important for us to talk about sex?
Well, because first of all, it's a subject that applies to every human being on this planet. Sex education shapes the society that we live in. It has a huge impact on our health, our safety, on the relationships that we build, understanding ourselves, understanding a different human being. On accepting ourselves and others, it's a huge element of our life. And I wasn't aware of this, I mean, until quite recently. And thanks to the people that I started to surround myself with and the educators that I spoke to, psychologists, sexologists, you know, a lot of things that I didn't know, suddenly, you know, it became obvious. Because it all started a little bit over 3 years ago, where in Poland, the current government was trying to change the abortion law. Abortion in Poland is illegal with a few exceptions. The exceptions are if you were raped, if the pregnancy is endangering your life, or if the fetus is heavily deformed. So this government now was trying to take those exceptions away and also introduce something very interesting, which would be basically if you were pregnant and you lost the pregnancy, there would be an investigation initiated to check whether you really lost a pregnancy or you removed it. So you can imagine what happens to the psychological side of that woman, who not only went through this drama of losing her baby, now she has to answer questions to the police whether she removed it on purpose. And I was really against that. I mean, I'm pro-abortion. I think she'll be legal until the 12th week. Of course, right now that in Poland will not change, but changing, you know, getting rid of these exceptions, that was just in my mind unacceptable. And I started to join marches. I spoke at protests, and I started to look at numbers, how abortion looks like in other countries. I wasn't aware back then that only Poland and Malta have illegal, are the only countries in the European Union that have, where abortion is still illegal. And then I looked at the numbers of abortions. When the more east you go and you look at Poland, the numbers are much higher than in other countries. Mm-hmm. And that has to do with the lack of sex education. And then I thought sex education, but I never had sex education in school. How does the situation look like now? And I started to do my research and meet with people, and the things that I started to realize and the information I was given was really shocking, because, I mean, I knew from, you know, I already knew that sex is a subject that's heavily taboo in Poland.
Worldwide, I would still
worldwide,
say.
Worldwide, yes. But yeah. In Poland, it's, well, yes, there's many countries that yeah. it's as taboo. But, you know, I'm Polish, so I was focusing on mm-hmm. on Poland at that moment. I know that you don't speak about sex at home. You don't speak about sex at school because you have no sex education. Even in relationships, you don't speak about sex. And I thought, okay, we have to do something about it. And then all the other information came that, you know, HIV, the amount of people infected with HIV in Poland is rising, that 60% of the people living in Poland with HIV, they are not aware of the fact that they have the virus. STIs are rocket high. Kids are really not aware of how their body functions, how their reproductive system functions. They don't know anything about contraception. Very often their first sexual experience is actually anal sex because they don't want to get pregnant. They don't think about STIs because no one tells them about STI. And then so many other things. Then I learned, you know, I spoke to psychologists and they started to explain to me what a huge impact, you know, sex education has on a kid that's growing up. What are kids told at school? There is a subject in Poland that is supposed to be the sex education. It's called learning how to live within a family. And it's mainly taught by priests and nuns, with a few exceptions, of course. And the things that are told are you know, crazy. And the book that goes along with, you know, the textbook that is in the educational system, in the textbook, it says that, you know, you shouldn't go to a gynecologist regularly. It's not a dentist. Girls are less intelligent than boys.
So that's still in schools.
Oh, yes. It's still at schools. It's still in the textbooks that masturbation is a sign of immaturity. Then the kids are told that it's evil and, you know, different things. Your hand is going to, you know, you're going to lose your arm or like things like that. What was the worst one that I heard? But I heard that much, much later from different girls around Poland, is that they're told that when they have their menstruation, their period, that these are the bloody tears of the vagina crying that there's no baby inside of her.
That's crazy.
I mean, yes. So crazy. I mean, you just, a lot of the stories I hear, you're just missing dragons and witches flying around because they're so abstract. I mean, it's quite, quite crazy. So a lot of people think that if you're sexually active, you have sex education. No, these are two different things. Sex education is something very, very different from being sexually active. Mm-hmm. So in some way, these kids are not giving information that, you know, that is really preparing us for life. Mm-hmm. And I thought, you know, I have to do something about it. Because what's incredible about, you know, my work and the position that I have right now, because when you, you know, when you really analyze it, is I got very, very lucky. I was born tall. I was born skinny. I was born white. I was born into a very loving family that supported my dreams. And of course, it was hard work. And of course, it was a lot of, you know, self-motivation to get to the position that I am at right now, which is, you know, working with the best people in the industry. But a lot of it is, you know, pure luck. But what is incredible about the position that I managed to reach in the industry is that it gives you a platform. And you can, with that platform, you can do so much. You can support people that, you know, don't necessarily have a loud voice. You can support initiatives that you believe in. You can take a subject that is important and spread the news, spread the information, and, you know, involve yourself in things that you care about and help organizations grow. So I felt that a little bit of that responsibility to do something about it. And I came up with this concept, the first campaign, that was called Let's Talk About Sex. And I just wanted, with that campaign, I just wanted to shine light on the problem, on the issue that there is a lack of sex education, and just start the conversation in Poland. And I came up with, you know, I decided that the campaign should live on social media, because nowadays that's the main source of information and education. And I created a series of 1-minute videos, invited well-recognized people from the world of fashion and movie and film. I mean, movie and film is the same, but music, and have them either tell a personal story that is connected to one of the subjects around sex education, or I would write a sketch for them and they would perform it. And then we released that in Poland. And it was a very big success. Over, I released it in a way where I would send the video to many different platforms. So after that, collecting all the information, how many people actually clicked on those videos was extremely difficult, because I didn't send the link to YouTube. I sent it individually, because I wanted all these platforms to feel that this is, they're part of the campaign. Mm. This is also their video that they're releasing on their platform, not just a YouTube video mm-hmm. that they connect into the article. And over 10 million people saw those clips. And then I started getting hundreds of letters from all around Poland, of, you know, teenagers and people more mature telling me how those videos impacted their lives, how they took parents and they set their parents in front of the screens and played the videos, and now they can talk about certain subjects. Also, we aired a episode about getting tested for HIV, mm-hmm. and at that point, all the free testing labs that we recommended had record turnouts for days. So there was a very, very big impact. And mm-hmm. when I saw the reaction of the society, I kind of realize, okay, this is a beginning. This is not a one-off. We have to do more.
Why do you think, because you got quite a lot of shit when you released it as well, yes. like if you can say that like that, why do you think that's still the case? Why are people so afraid of a female body, or like a human body in general, and like dealing with all those things that are central and that you in a way can't really control? Or is that even the reason why people are scared of it?
Yeah, you know, people are scared of the things that they don't know. And I think the fact that there is no sex education in Poland, they don't even know what sex education is, most of them. They think, a lot of them, they say I'm sexualizing kids. So I'm kind of convincing kids to have kids and teenagers to have more and more and more sex. Where the reality is that
they have it anyways. No?
They have it anyway. That's one thing. Second thing is that someone goes through a proper sex education, the moment of the first sexual, you know, contact usually is later, because kids that are aware of their body, they're aware of what sex is, they're a little bit more responsible, they usually you know, they don't feel the pressure of the surrounding to have it just behind them and to do it. They're also more prepared for it. They know it's a sort of responsibility and they feel strong enough to decide when it's right for them.
Do you remember the way that you've been educated about sex?
I was not educated about
sex. Not at all.
No. And I spoke to my mom quite recently and I'm like, Mom, what's the deal? You never spoke about sex. And she's like, you know what? I don't know. We just thought you're going to. No. I'm like, how would I know? I mean, I was lucky that nothing happened.
Mm.
But I remember this little thing with my sister. I have an older sister. She's 8 years older and she was going on vacation for the first time by herself. And there was a lot of like a little bit of tension. My dad was whispering with my mom and we walked her to the train station. She was jumping on the train. And suddenly my dad gives her a condom and runs away. You know, just handed her condoms and then ran away. My sister went red. My dad was red. My mom was red. I mean, it was just so ridiculous. No conversation, not even explaining what that is. She probably had no clue how to put that on properly. Mm. I mean, so abstract. And I asked them, you're doctors, you're vets. I mean, what the hell? And they're like, we don't know.
Mm.
You know, when speaking to different educators, you kind of realize how difficult it is for someone to be born in Poland in a society that doesn't accept different sexual orientations. And apart from going through all the teenage dramas and all the, you know, doubts about yourself and who you are and drama with your parents, on top of that, you're questioning so many other things because you're not fitting in and you're realizing you're not fitting in. And you don't, if you don't have a support system around you, if you don't understand it, if there's no one to explain to you that this is normal, that you're okay, you're part of the society, you just have a different sex orientation. You know, this leads to a lot of drama, a lot of, you know, insecurity and very sometimes even in some cases, if you're not accepted by the society, to suicide.
Mm.
I mean, the worst things in Poland and in different places around the world, they're camps where you go to a camp and they're supposed to set you straight and turn you from homo to heterosexual. I mean, it's so abstract. And now what is so crazy is that, you know, knowledge is on our side. Like it's proven that this, your sex orientation, you receive that in your DNA.
Mm.
So it's not something you can change.
Mm.
You're born with it. So I just still don't understand why nowadays it's such a controversial, you know, subject. Let people love who they want to love. Let them kiss who they want to kiss. I mean, there's so many issues around the world that are so much more dangerous for us as humans and for the planet than, you know, focusing on, you know, forbidding someone to love who they want.
But maybe that's also a reason why people, like older people, are so scared of that, because it's something that is close by and maybe they think they can change it. Because if you think about the really like big problems like climate change or whatever, that's still more abstract, and maybe someone being close and a man kissing a man or a woman kissing a woman.
That they can control that.
That they can control that better. And maybe, I don't know, that just came up to my mind. Maybe that's.
It could be, but they can't control that.
No, they can't. No, they can't. Obviously, they can't control it, but maybe they think they can control it. And maybe it's also what you said before, that it's because people hate change, or like, and that's a change, and it's been around forever, but it hasn't been openly around. So maybe that even that now it's public, that people just don't, they can't grasp it, or they don't want to grasp it, because it means things are changing and power structures are crumbling down, and it's in way into a new society, maybe.
It is, but, you know, a big thing is we don't have sex education. Sex education speaks about different sex orientations and explains what that really is and what, you know, sex identification means. And if you don't know, you can be very easily manipulated into thinking that it's something that is endangering, how they like to say in Poland, endangering the Polish family values. No, that's not the case.
What does that do to you that people are so aggressive towards you and your beliefs? What does that do to someone?
I usually handle it quite fine. when I heard in Poland that I mentioned on during masses at churches, that slightly scares me because I believe in energy. And then I see, you know, like 100 people in a church all at the same time sending me bad energy, like a collective source of bad energy. And that really freaks me out. But my initial reaction is I feel sad because they don't understand. They don't know. They're lacking the information. And they live in a surround, they're surrounded by people that don't know either. And they're living in a bubble, you know, living, I mean, their bubble is probably bigger than my bubble, but
a different bubble.
But just, you know, to have so much hate inside of you and take time to write hateful comments and take time to, you know, to engage in that, that must feel awful, you know? Because after that, maybe they feel a sort of relief in that moment. But at the end, I think it goes back. I don't think you're a happy person if you do that.
Like energies again.
Yes, it's all energy.
And forth. In your modeling career, you worked a lot, like you did a lot of nude pictures as well. Did that change your approach to sexuality? Because you said you never had sex education and then you thrown in that world and your body's used and also always judged in a way.
Well, when you asked me earlier, a good tips for someone that wants to start to model, this is actually a good subject. Because when you start modeling, you must understand that your body is your tool of work. And it's you, but it's not you at the same time. You're, like I said earlier, an extension of someone's vision. And even if I decide to do a naked picture, pose nude, it's a very conscious decision. Mm-hmm. It's usually a team that I feel very comfortable with. I did say no many times because not that I was afraid, but I just knew that our level of aesthetics or of understanding nudity and body were very, very different, and I wouldn't be happy with the result. Mm-hmm. So that's when I say no. But I don't think posing naked is sexual in any way. Mm-hmm.
Can you elaborate on that?
It's a form of art, you know. We are all built the same way. We all have our bodies. I mean, there are differences where, you know, someone's a bit bigger, someone's smaller, someone has big boobs, someone has small boobs, longer legs, shorter legs. But at the end of the day, it's the same body. And I think it's beautiful and I think it's very natural and we should take care of it and we should celebrate it. And taking a beautiful image and naked beautiful image, I think it's an element of celebration of, you know, of ourselves or of our bodies or of humans or of women, of men, depending who's taking, you know, who's on the picture. And I think it's very natural. You know what it was? I was yesterday it was my first time at a place called Vabali here in Berlin.
Super nice.
It's super nice.
Yeah.
And, you know, I was thinking there's so many parts of the world where that could not exist. And we're, you know,
people are naked.
Mm-hmm. Yes. So at that place, you have to be naked. You're not allowed to have swimwear. And when you go into a steam room or a sauna, you're naked or you're naked swimming in the pool. And it felt so natural. You don't feel like you're judged. No one is staring. No one is, you know, it's not sexual at all. Almost asexual, I would say.
Yeah, true.
And it's beautiful. And you're all there how we were born. And it's incredible.
But that's actually weird. I never thought about it. But when places, because Germans and Austrians, they just love being naked in saunas and love being naked in the spa. But then in society or when you see a naked picture, it's still sexualized in a way, even though those places are the most asexual place ever. No one like stares at your boobs or no one looks at someone's penis or whatever. It's actually a weird.
But I thought it was incredible because that's a beautiful approach to body. You know, because it's on one hand, you know, even for me, I mean, at the beginning, I was like, oh, okay. And then you feel very comfortable. And it builds a very healthy relationship with yourself and someone else's nudity. And it's also healthy to see all these different bodies. I mean, you're not staring, but you still see these people. And they come in different forms and sizes. And And yes, that's interesting that you said the moment you're outside of that place, they have a different approach.
Even when you think about things like social media on Instagram, it's still like female bodies are censored. You can't show nipples. That's actually such a weird...
Very, very strange.
Very, very strange.
Because you can post the most vulgar gross picture. But the moment your nipple is covered, you can see the whole breast. It's just about the nipple, which is very strange. Because it's not even about the whole breast. It's just that little nipple, which is actually identical with men.
What kind of message do you think that sends to the public that on Instagram nipples are not okay?
Well, I think it sends a wrong message when it comes to, you know, nudity and, you know, accepting your body, that suddenly, you know, there's something wrong with the nipple, that it's a nipple so sexual you can't show it. It's also not fair towards, you know, the audience, because you basically don't let them judge the image by themselves or build their own relationship with that image and their own set of values when it comes to nudity. You're making a decision for them that this is something they should not be seeing because it's wrong. So basically they're saying a nipple is wrong. How can an element of your body be wrong?
And also,
but it's a detachment. I mean, in one of the chapters in the book, which is called actually Fall in Love with Your Pussy, and there's one Fall in Love with Your Dick. because in many countries, people are so detached from their sexual organs. They don't, you know, they're 40, 50-year-old adults that go to a doctor and they say they have a problem down there. They don't even have a name for it.
True.
And there's so many women that they don't know how they're built. They never took a mirror to have a look. So if there's a problem, they don't know if this is how they, you know, if there is a problem, there's no problem, because if they don't know how they looked down there, as they say, before, it's part of our body, you know, it should be treated just as our, I don't know, we take, you know, teeth and a finger and an elbow. I mean, it's part of us. How can we just completely detach from that spot? And especially that place that gives us so much pleasure, gives birth, you know, gives life. It should be even more celebrated.
Yeah. I mean, we all come from there in a way.
We all come, I mean, not in a way.
We literally come from there.
Yes.
True.
You know, I said this, made this statement recently that sex is who we are and sex is what we will become. And I was like, no. I'm like, yes, that's who we are. We all come from sex.
Yeah.
Someone has to have a sexual, you know, and there has to be intercourse for
us to be here.
Us to be there.
What was the biggest lesson that you learned through sex at PL and your activism?
That nothing is impossible. That if you really set your mind to it, you will do it. I mean, when I first had the idea of the campaign, it wasn't easy. I had this big idea. I was, you know, on my own, and I called so many people to be part of it. And I heard more often no than yes, because it's a very tricky subject in Poland. A lot of people were afraid to speak openly about sex, even subjects like consent. You know, I understand that not everyone feels comfortable to speak about masturbation. And I don't want to force anyone, you know, to do that if they don't feel comfortable. But, you know, consent, I mean, I think we all agree about consent, that it's needed in sex, whether you're in a relationship or not. So there are a lot of closed doors before anything happened. But you have to kind of push through. But it could have been something that I already learned from modeling. Because I worked for quite some time before, you know, I managed to break through. I was not discovered in McDonald's and suddenly made a career. I was working and struggling, and I actually gave myself a period of time, 2 years, to make it to the top of the industry. Mm-hmm. By the top, I meant just working with the best people in the industry for the best magazines and brands. If not, I'd go back to school, because I didn't want to do it halfway. And, you know, a lot of the things that did happen was because I took action. You know, my first big job that helped me with my career was the Chloe campaign with Inez. And that happened, I was in a studio in Paris, and back then, I mean, they already had computers, but they have this huge board where they write the number of the studio and the shoots that are happening and what photographers are working there. And I arrived to work, I think, for a German, some German small magazine. And I looked at the board and I saw Inez and Venud, and I was like, oh my God, I always wanted to meet them. So I had this idea that during lunchtime, I'm going to, you know, walk into the studio by accident, thinking it's my studio. And, you know, maybe I'll bump into them. I mean, there was no bigger plan apart from, you know, just bumping into them. And that's what I did. And during lunchtime, I walked in. And at that point, when I walked in, I'm like, oh, I don't know if I actually can recognize Inez. How does she look like? And obviously, the production level was very different to the production where I was at, where there were like three people, four people. And here there's like 100 people all around. And I just stood there and I'm like, shit. And then when I was about to turn around, someone said, oh, who are you? Hi, are you lost? And that was actually Inez. And, you know, she spoke to me. She's very, her energy is magnetic, the way she speaks to you and her look with the black, black hair. And she always looks with her blue, blue eyes, and she kind of moves when she looks. It's an experience. It's incredible. She's very animalistic, actually, in her behavior. And, you know, she was very nice, and she took a Polaroid of me. And the next thing I knew, I was booked for the Chloe campaign. So there was another situation with Jürgen Teller that happened. Mm-hmm. And you know the story maybe, but because I said it, I already said it in an interview once, and I never worked with him. And this was quite recently. It was maybe 4 or 5 years ago. So I was already, you know, working for many, many years, because I've been working for 20 years now. And I never met him. I never got to work with him, and I loved his work. And we were staying at the same hotel. And I asked the reception to print my boarding, my ticket, because I was going from Paris to London on a Eurostar. And she gave me the ticket, and she gave me the wrong ticket. She gave me Jürgen's ticket. And I was like, oh, it's not my ticket, because he asked for the same thing. I didn't know he was staying at that time at the hotel. And I looked at his time, and he was taking the train an hour after me. So I was like, let me change my, this is a mistake. I actually should be on the other train. And of course, no plan whatsoever. And I went to the station. I'm like, I'll see him or I don't see him. And then I spotted him, and I just came up and said, you know, I love your work. I hope you're going to work at some point. And just wanted to say that. And I boarded, and the train, you know, left. And a few minutes later, I see him walking and looking around. So I wave, and he sits down, and we have a chat. And he said, well, you said you wanted to work with me. I have my assistant here with the equipment. Why don't we do a shoot now? And I'm like, yeah. So we shot, our first shoot was on the Eurostar. Mm-hmm. He never knew, and I don't think he really still knows that I did that little trick and changed my train ticket.
Does Inez know?
Inez, I think I told Inez quite recently.
Okay.
And she remembers me walking into the studio, but it wasn't as big of a moment for her as it was for me. So she remembers vaguely. She remembers booking me for the job. And then I did Chloe for many, many seasons. And I worked with Inez, still work with her for so many years.
Talking about Jürgen Teller, you shot Vogue Poland, the first Vogue Poland cover with him. Was that also your first big shoot for a magazine then, or was that something
with him?
With him?
No, I think I shot with him twice before.
Okay.
But maybe never Vogue.
Okay.
So that was my first Vogue with Jürgen Teller.
Because Vogue Poland, you also did a collaboration with Sex at PL. You did the video together.
Yes.
And I think it's beautiful to see how Vogue Poland takes a stand for the subjects. Can you maybe talk a little bit of your relationship with them?
I feel so close to them, you know, and it was wonderful that they supported Sex at PL. They had from the very beginning, because when I started the movement, they gave me a permanent spot on their page where they write about Sex at PL and all the things that are happening regularly. So it's updated every week, every 2 weeks, depending what we're doing. They wrote about a collaboration that I did because I wanted to reach people, you know, to make, first of all, make sex education approachable and fun and interesting, find different points of engagement to mm-hmm. engage people. And the best way to do that is through art, through fashion, through things, you know, that, people are interested in. So I approached them to, I first approached them with a different idea. I forgot about that because I wanted to create a competition for young photographers that, in their work, they, speak about, you know, sexuality and finding your sexual orientation and accepting yourself. And do a competition where they send in, they create pictures for Sex at PL, send in the pictures. We received over 30,000 images. We picked, we were supposed to pick 10 people, but we picked 14 at the end because we couldn't decide. And then had a curator come in and curate a big exhibition at the Museum of Modern Art in Warsaw. So these kids suddenly had an exhibition at the, you know, one of the most important museums in Poland. So that was really fun. So Vogue entered this way, Sex at PL and the collaboration. Then I wanted, because there were so many kids that wanted to be part of the movement, and a great way to let people do that is through fashion, because fashion, you know, allows you to show instantly what you identify with, what you support. And I approached this brand, Misbehave, that is doing actually quite well abroad as well. Mm-hmm. And I didn't want to produce anything. So I asked them for things that, you know, didn't sell before, or samples, t-shirts and hoodies. And we wanted to print things or cut those pieces up and create, give these clothes a new life mm-hmm. and sell them later on. And Vogue joined that project as well. It went very, very well because mm-hmm. the collection sold out in 45 minutes, which is
45 minutes.
Wow. But the great thing is we didn't produce anything, which mm-hmm. is wonderful. And we collaborated with Curtis Kulig, who's a street artist mm-hmm. in New York, and we had this sign, safe sex, safe world. And it was really fun to do it.
Nice.
And kids, you know, kids, not even kids, but anyone that identifies with the message of sex ed PL, because mm-hmm. it's much more than just learning about contraception, and it's much more than learning about STIs. It's, you know, it gives, this is the first almost support system in Poland that managed to grow as big as it is right now mm-hmm. for people that did not get the support from, didn't feel the support. They didn't feel part of the society. They didn't feel that they have the right to exist. Mm-hmm. And I'm very proud of this, that this movement gave them that.
Mm-hmm. Last question, because the first season of this podcast is about Vogue Germany turning 40, and maybe that's a little bit of a big jump in the theme now, but where do you think will Vogue develop in the next 40 years?
Vogue has an insane power, just like fashion does. You know, we are, the fashion industry creates trends faster than any other industry on this planet. We're such a great point of engagement. We can address so many subjects and issues through fashion. And I think right now is a very exciting moment in time, because people in fashion are starting to understand and realize they have a huge impact on people around the world, and they can change things. And I think that awareness is really, really important. So I see, I mean, Vogue could, you know, is slowly becoming a platform that is, of course, heavily focused on fashion, but at the same time, you know, builds out to so many other subjects and builds a whole lifestyle and builds a whole, you know, way of thinking and can go easily also in education. I think it's going to become more and more a platform than just a magazine.
Mm-hmm. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Ich hoffe, euch hat das Gespräch genauso gut gefallen wie mir. Abonniert den Podcast doch jetzt auf Spotify, Apple, Deezer oder Soundcloud. Schreibt mir gern an onlineredaktion@vogue.de und erzählt mir eure Vogue-Stories oder schreibt mir eure Gästewünsche. Auf vogue.de findet ihr jetzt mehr zum Thema. Ich freue mich, von euch zu hören. Der Podcast wurde produziert von Mit Vergnügen. Ich bin Alexandra Bondi-De Antoni. Ciao, Baba, und bis zum nächsten Mal.